is I am going to give you a whirlwind tour of Waterlaw today in 25 minutes or less. And then we'll be getting into more specific issues as we go throughout the session. Couple things I want to let you know. First of all, I haven't figured out how to turn off the noise when I get emails. So you may be hearing dings while I'm talking. That's my email, or it could be yours. Second of all, the smoke has really gotten to me, so I may have to sign off for a minute and have a coughing fit, but then I'll come back on. Also, you might notice that we are recording. You'll see the recording button up in the left-hand column. We are recording so that others can then come back and look at these presentations if they've missed them. And so those of you here from the public especially and from the class, if you have to miss a class, you won't really miss it because we will be making those available on Canvas for the students and on the website for those of you in the public. Also on Canvas and on the website, we will be posting reading assignments, essentially, which are intended mostly to just give you a background to some of the issues you're going to hear from the speakers. The first reading assignment for this class and the next one is called The Citizen's Guide to Water Law in Colorado, or Colorado Water Law. I have the website is there, so you can link right to it. And look at that, it's a really good, it's 32 pages of what water in Colorado is all about. So if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you look at it. And then we'll have other additional readings as we go by. So with that, I'm gonna share my screen and we're gonna talk about a couple more things about the class, and then we're gonna dive into a whirlwind of water law. Can everybody see that? Okay, if you can't see it, speak up. Okay, thank you. So, let's see if I can get it going here. Okay, Nancy, it's not doing it. Oh, there we go. Okay, so course overview. We're gonna talk a little bit about Colorado, Western, and federal water law. We're gonna talk about federal, state, regional, and local water institutions. We'll have the state engineer here, Kevin Ryan. We'll have the director of the Water Policy Agency for the state of Colorado next week. That's Colorado Water Conservation Board, and that's Becky Mitchell. We're gonna talk about water administration, water quality. We'll have Nicole Rowan here from CDPHE, which is the agency that administers our water quality laws. We're gonna talk about creation of laws and policy. I've been fortunate to get Representative Jenny Arndt to spend an hour with us and talking about her experience at the Capitol. And she's been very active in working on water issues from her chair as representative. We're gonna talk about the role of science. I have Brad Udall coming. Brad is known internationally for his climate work and his work on Colorado River. And he'll be talking to us in November, I think. Unfortunately, another friend of mine, John Echohawk, who works for the Native American Rights Fund, will spend an hour talking to us about Federal Reserve water rights, focusing mostly on Native American water rights, which are an important piece of water in the West and on federal stage. Then we'll have, as I mentioned before, we're gonna have that interplay with politics. So for the students, the syllabus is posted on Canvas. But as a reminder, you need to attend the seminars. That's 60% of your grade. You need to read the assignments before each class. And then the final project is 40% of your grade. And I'm asking that you give me a paper, 2 to 4 pages, not long, on law, policy development, and influence of politics on a major Western water issues of your choice. And if you feel like you want some ideas, I'm happy to throw some out. I want those papers due on November 30th. That's the class right after Thanksgiving. And I will be asking for class presentations of those papers. So with that, I'm going to stop, and especially with the students, see if there are any questions. And they're going to unmute you for that. So anybody have a question? I can't see all of you, so I'm assuming not. Okay, great. Okay, so let's go. Water law in the West is different than water law in the East. There are two water law systems in the United States. The Eastern part of the United States uses what's called the riparian system. And this is reasonably used by riparian landowners. And when there's a shortage, which is rare, but getting more and more so these days, the adage is share and share alike. In other words, you use what you can, but you make sure your neighbor has enough to use what he needs also. The prior appropriation system is much different. It's based on any party can use the water. You do not have to be next to the stream like you do in a riparian system. Shortages are dealt with by those who have first come on and use the water right. They have the first right. They can use, if there's only so much in the stream and they have a water right for that amount, they can use it all. The other difference is that rights are transferable. So the prior appropriation system came to us basically because of miners. The mining system set up that if you were first to lay a claim on your mining interest, then you were entitled to it. That flew over then, rolled over then into the use of water on your rights. And water then, since all gold wasn't right near the stream, they started pumping water up to where the gold is to get it. Then that's where we got our claims of first in time and first in right. The water laws were first established by the Colorado Territorial Court, and all of the Western states in one form or another have the prior appropriation system as a basis. This did, however, cause a significant alteration of rivers and leads us to a time in the 70s when we started paying attention to that and trying to make up for some of the damage that had been done. The doctrine of appropriation is in the state constitution. It says that the right to divert the unappropriated waters of any natural stream to beneficial use shall never be denied. It is still in the constitution and it will stay in the constitution. So that's, it's a constitutional right, it's a property right. A little quick history on water development in the West. The 1860s, first we had the gold rush, 1840s, 1850s. Then in the 1860s, we started seeing agriculture. Here in the Poudre Valley and in eastern Colorado, miners came looking for gold. The miners, some of the miners didn't find gold, but they decided they needed to feed the other miners. And so they ended up farming and establishing ditches to irrigate their farm. Then those farmers joined together to get a larger scale diversion projects. In 1880, we have our first transbasin diversion from Colorado River. In the 1890s, we have the reservoir construction boom, and then in 1902, the Bureau of Reclamation, a United States agency, starts building large projects. And that's the Cooley Dams, the Hoover Dams, and many, let's see, Pueblo Reservoir. There are many, many Bureau projects in Colorado. And in the 1930s then, there was groundwater development. Groundwater law is different than the prior appropriation system if the groundwater is not adjacent or is not touched by the stream. Kevin Ryan, state engineer, is going to talk a little bit more about groundwater development, so you'll hear more about that later. Again, the prior appropriation system is that if you have the first right, you get everything, or you get what you need first, and then the second in line gets what he or she needs. The water has to be put to beneficial use without waste or speculation. So you couldn't pull water from the stream just to pull water from the stream. This has become an issue sometimes when in modern eras, when people with land have tried to put ponds on their land, and whether that's an appropriate beneficial use or not to get a water right has caused a lot of discussion in the water rights arena. You can have remote uses and you can sell your water rights, so it is not attached to the land. But if you don't use it, you can lose it. And the state engineer will also probably talk about every 10 years, the state engineer puts out an abandonment list. And water rights that have not been used regularly are subject to go before the court. And if there's no intent to use them or intent shown to use them, then those rights can be abandoned. So here are the basics of Colorado water rights. It's owned by the people of the state. It's a usufructuary right. That means you have the right to use it. Water must be applied to beneficial use with minimal waste. A water right is assigned a priority date when it's adjudicated by the water court. And water rights are described by a point of diversion, beneficial use, and an amount. The value of a water right is its priority, its dependability. I'm going to stop there. And Nancy, can you guys take them off mute for a minute and see if we can see if there are any questions or thoughts? Or I'm hoping most of you have this basic amount of knowledge on it, but I want to make sure in case you haven't. Okay, not hearing anything, I'm going to go on then. So in Colorado, and the state engineer will talk about this, the legislature determined to divide up Colorado into seven water divisions. We're in Division One, which is essentially the South Platte River. Two is the Arkansas. Three is the Rio Grande. Four is the Upper Gunnison area. Five is the Upper Colorado area. Six is Yampa, White, and the North Platte, and seven is the San Miguel, San Juan, and Animas Rivers. Each of those divisions has a judge appointed as a water judge. That judge hears the water right cases. You cannot get a water right in Colorado with just a permit. Colorado is the only state that requires you can only get a water right by going to court and getting it adjudicated. Now, I don't mean a water right. I mean, you can get a water right by using the water, but you can't protect it unless you get a water right decree from the court. And so that's why the courts are important. Also, the state engineer has what he calls division engineers in each of those divisions, who pretty much administer the water rights for that division. Now, recall that we said you had to have beneficial uses of the right. Early on, that meant essentially that you had to take the water out of the river. If you did not divert it, then it wasn't a beneficial use. So those uses pretty much were for agriculture, ranching, some industry. The exception to that was power generation, but we have grown in how we define a beneficial use, which was has been very controversial in the history of beneficial use definitions. Now we find beneficial use as snowmaking. We see it taking care of municipalities and industry. Recreation is a beneficial use, as is fish and wildlife, essentially, and in-stream flows. In the 1970s, I'll talk more about this at a later time, there was an awakening of late 60s and into the 70s, awakening of the damage we were doing to the environment on several levels. And Colorado realized that we did need to protect our streams, and the legislature passed the in-stream flow law. The condition on that in-stream flow was that it had to be applied for by the Colorado Water Conservation Board, a state agency, that individuals could not have in-stream flows. However, in another development in the early 2000s, we have what's called recreational rights that entities, public entities, mostly cities, counties, can set up kayaking courses. And these are essentially non-diversional rights that can happen so long as something is done to manipulate the river. And in fact, Fort Collins, I believe, has a course like that. This is a map you'll definitely see from the state engineer, if not other people. And we lovingly call this the snake map. As you can see, it is a picture of all the outflow of rivers from the state of Colorado. The state of Colorado is the headwaters for 9 different rivers. And we then have to share this water with those downstream states. You can see Colorado River is the largest that flows out, but Arkansas, Rio Grande, South Platte, they too are pretty substantial. So because we have to share these rivers with our neighbors, a new kind of law developed, essentially. How are 2 states going to do that? How are 6 states or 7 states on the Colorado River going to do that? So there are several ways that have developed to do that. You can do it by direct legislation by Congress, which is how the lower basin of the Colorado River is split up, was done by federal legislation. You can file an original action lawsuit in the United States Supreme Court, which is allowed under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Original actions started happening a lot in the early 20th century, in the early 1900s. It was a new law. How do you take 2 states, Wyoming and Colorado was a big example, who both looked at the prior appropriation system. How do you divide the river up? If the river starts in Colorado and goes into Wyoming, but the senior rights are in Wyoming, what happens to those senior rights in Colorado? And so the United States Supreme Court started to hear several of these controversies. And originally started saying that first in kept with the first in time, first in right general rule. So for instance, even though Colorado had maybe more uses, Wyoming had a senior right, and so most of the water went to Wyoming and those what the Supreme Court called senior rights. This scared the bejesus out of those of us in Colorado. As we looked at other rivers and how fast some of our neighbors were using water, especially on the Colorado River, where California was just starting to develop. So then what developed was we decided, Colorado, because a Colorado water attorney stepped up to the plate, put forth this theory, and it was accepted by many other states. So now what states did is they made an agreement among themselves. It's a compact under the compact clause of the United States Constitution. There would be negotiations between members of the states. A compact would be decided in 1922. That happened with the Colorado River. Then each of the states, the governor's representatives, signed on to the agreement, but that wasn't good enough. Then it had to go to the governors and then to the state legislators. So each state legislature had to approve that compact. Six of the seven basin states did that. Arizona did not on the Colorado River. Then, under the compact clause, it needs to be approved by Congress. And so that happened. So almost all of the compacts we have now in the Western United States are approved by Congress, which means that they are state law and they are federal law. And they're governed basically by the law of agreements and contracts. So we have, I want to say nine, but that's probably about right, interstate compacts. Besides the compacts, we also have a couple of court decrees, one on the Platte River, which is again that Wyoming versus Colorado lawsuit I talked about earlier. And then there's another one that I can't remember right off the bat here, but that's how most of these compacts have compact commissions, which essentially govern how the compact is controlled, making sure that people are taking only what they're supposed to. In Colorado's case, since we're upstream, people just want to make sure that we let enough of the water go downstream. Some compacts have us deliver a certain amount of water at the border. Others have us deliver a percentage of the flow. It's very interesting. And if you're interested more in compacts, I'd refer you to last year's presentations. I do believe they're still on the website. And we went into individually some of these compacts. So I think you'd find it interesting to do that yourself. We also are subject to an international water treaty, the 1945 treaty with Mexico on the Rio Grande, Tijuana, and Colorado rivers. The treaty is administered by an interstate or international agency called the International Boundary and Water Commission, which has a United States side and a Mexican side. So under the treaty, we on the Colorado River are required to deliver 150,000 acre feet of water a year to Mexico. I stopped because that doesn't feel right. It might be 1.5 million. I'm getting confused, but I'll come back to that. Anyway, so we have the treaty we have to deal with. We will spend one of our sessions on federal water law in institutions. I talked about the compacts, which are federal law. But we also have the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species NEPA, National Environmental Protection Agency Act, and then the international treaties. So that's my whirlwind tour, but in dealing with water, you hear certain maxims about water. And I thought, if you hadn't heard this before, I wanted you to hear it now, because I always find these a bit amusing. First maxim is that water flows uphill to money. If you talk to Denver Water, that is something they know for sure. They have always been the big gorilla, and they've been able to get the water that they need. The other one you've heard, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. Some attributed that to Mark Twain, but we don't know if that's true or not. And this is one of my favorites. I'd rather be upstream with a shovel than downstream with a water right. So you may have a senior water right, but if you're upstream with a shovel, you might get a shot at that water before the state engineer shuts you down. And with that, I'm going to stop sharing my screen and come back. And I am sorry that was so fast, but I want to refer you to the Citizen's Guide that I talked about, because that is a very thorough view of what's happening in water law. The compacts, the wells, just how it's developed. And so with that, I'd see if there are any thoughts or questions out there. Okay, then let me give you a story. You know, I talked about politics. Well, in the case I talked about between Wyoming and Colorado, Wyoming was suing Colorado, saying that we were taking too much of the water out of the Laramie River, actually it was, not the Platte, Laramie River. And what I found out last year in doing some research is that when you went to the Supreme Court in the early 1900s, it was very interesting. You did not talk to the whole court like you do today. You would have one judge who determined what was going on. He would hold the hearings and he would decide, and he would write an opinion for the Supreme Court, and then his fellow judges just signed off on it. Well, bringing politics into that, the Supreme Court judge that was handed the Laramie River case was from Wyoming. And not only was he from Wyoming, but he had represented clients, the same clients that were complaining about Colorado using the water. He also decided to have private conversations with Wyoming's engineer, which he cited in the Supreme Court opinion. Then he wrote the opinion in Wyoming's favor, and we got the Laramie decree, Laramie River decree. So what did Colorado do about that? Well, Colorado knew about this connection. They knew about these meetings. But here's the politics of it. What do? Do you tell a Supreme Court judge that he's not being truthful? How do you think that's going to work for your case? So even in the law, politics gets intertwined. Now, in my opinion, the judge did a decent job of setting forth how he at least laid out to us how the river was to be divided up. Colorado didn't like it. Wyoming got the better piece of that. But the issue was resolved. And so that's the piece I want to try to give you as we go through some of these issues. There's policies and there's laws, but there's politics that plays into that. We're going to see that a lot in the 1970s, when people started paying attention to the environment and how that plays, like with our in-stream flow law. So I'm going to stop there. See if there are any other comments or questions. You've all been very attentive. I want to thank you so much, especially those of you who joined us and aren't signed up for the class. Next week, we'll have Becky Mitchell here, who is director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. She's going to talk a bit about the board and the water policies that they consider. And the biggest water policy of all, you probably know, is the water plan, the Colorado Water Plan. And she was instrumental in writing that plan. And I asked her to talk about how they did it, you know, what some of the conclusions were, update on what's happening since the water plan, but also how did politics work in that. If you're new to the water business, even if you're not, you may not know that we have what's called an East Slope, West Slope controversy going on constantly. There are 20% of the people who live in Colorado on the West Slope and 80% on the East Slope. However, 80% of the water is on the West Slope and 20 on the east. So we have Trans Mountain diversions, and people on the West Slope are very cautious about any more water going over the divide. They want to protect their environment in